Welcome to Worlds Apart. As the popular saying goes, you can never get enough of what you don't need, but that doesn't stop people or whole nations from trying to get more. Both the modern economy and today's politics are predicated on goals and objectives that have little to do with a meaningful or balanced life. Quite the contrary, they often manufacture dependencies and conflict as the way of sustaining themselves. Can that be changed, and if so, by whom? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Thomas Paley, an American economist, author of several books, including Plenty of Nothing, and the founder of the Economics for Democratic and Open Societies Project. Mr. Paley, it's a great honor, great pleasure for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this.
Now, you're not only a prominent economist, but also, I think, to some extent, an economic historian. And what I really like about your approach is that you factor in psychology, culture, morality as a way of explaining economic behavior of people or whole nations. And using this very comprehensive lens, I want to start by asking, where do you think the global economy finds itself at this very point?
I won't answer in terms of strong, weak, whatever. I think I'd like to use a schoolmaster. I'll give it a grade, and I'd give it a C grade. And of course, to understand the global economy, it consists of pieces. And so I think of there being as three pieces of significance right now. The first, of course, is the United States, and there's Europe, and then let us call the rest of the world. And in the United States, we're having a macroeconomic boom. We see it in our stock market numbers and so on. But there's a lot of discontent on the ground. And I would say to people that our boom is very much a financial boom. And so things can end quite suddenly with finance. You might say, I guess there's something that's so stupid, it may be insightful. The longer it goes on, the closer we are to the end. With Europe, the economy is weak. It's quite clear. They're either in recession or on the edge of recession. And in the rest of the world, the economy is stagnant. And in the background, there's a good possibility of some sort of financial problems, financial crisis from the accumulated debt. Put that together, and the best that you can say is it's a C grade.
I mentioned in the introduction that you are the founder of the Economics for Democratic and Open Societies project. And those very terms, democratic and open societies, are very hard to define because, you know, America, for example, considers itself as a model democracy. But the current choice for presidency you have this year is quite narrow and some would say disappointing. So like the quality of that open society is quite debatable. What do you put into those terms? What does it mean to have a democracy or to have an open society in this day and age?
The term open society comes from the philosopher Karl Popper. And it sort of comes from Popper's views on science. People think that the truth is accessible, that there is a truth out there and we can get it. And Popper showed that even in science, that is not possible. And it's really very clear why. We just don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, we believe the sun is going to rise, but we have to admit that we can't be certain because we don't know the future. So it is possible. It is conceivable. And in fact, one day, probably the sun won't rise. But what's true in science is even more true in social science and what we know about societies. So if we can't know the truth, we must always keep an open mind to the possibility that we are wrong, and we need institutions that govern us and arrange social life in that way, and that's why Popper was advocate of pluralism. It's not because pluralism is such a great thing in itself, but it's the only way that we can have of dealing with this very fundamental problem, and that's what I mean by open society. Well, democracy is something else. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to continue because, I mean, truth is obviously in the eye of the beholder. And we in Russia even have two words for the concept of truth. One is something that is eternal and not accessible to humans. And another one that is very personal. But in my society, at least, there is such a concept as justice and fairness. And this is something that also in the eye of the beholder. And yet there are some social dimensions that could be sort of work towards and achieved. When you mentioned that the American economy is now at its boom, do you think this boom is democratically distributed?
One person's arc is another person's plot, and that's true of social life and these ethical things. And that's why we have to sort of socially negotiate them. And that's part of how what a good political system does is it tries and negotiates them in a way that delivers what we can all join together as saying roughly reasonable, fair outcomes. In the United States, clearly not. There's a tremendous inequality, and there's a lot of unhappiness, as I said, on the ground, as people struggle to make it meet. And that's, by the way, part of the cause of our political problems. And by the way, it's actually very much why I started this Economics for Democratic and Open Societies project, because I used to work with the labor unions here. And I also worked for a while with George Soros, who I know is not such a popular figure anymore in Russia. But the idea was that if you want this society, you have to ask yourself, what is the economic basis that will support it? And by the way, that's what George Soros never did. And that's why I believe his project is ultimately failing. He never engaged this question. What is the economic system that will support democracy? What is the economic system that will support open society? Mm-hmm. And this is a question that has to be on the table. And we in the United States and Europe have failed. Other countries are trying to answer it in different ways. And I understand why they're doing it. They come from a different place historically.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think that question is at the very crux of geopolitics today. The Biden administration often uses this theme of the existential fight of democracies against autocracies, and obviously it includes Russia in the list of autocracies. But I know from my personal experience covering many international meetings that this theme is primarily used for domestic consumption. Internationally, big democracies like India, Brazil, South Africa, they couldn't be bothered about other countries' political or ideological organization. They are mostly concerned about mutual trade, about crime, about transborder issues, you know, pragmatic matters. Why do you think this theme of democracy is so prominent, or danger to democracy is so prominent in the United States? Why is it outwardly rather than inwardly focused? And who is a danger to whom here?
Very good point. So much there. I agree that today in the United States, our foreign policy establishment, our national security establishment, is weaponizing democracy. I don't believe we have any interest in promoting democracy at all.
Do you even know what democracy is? Do they know what democracy means?
Let's get it. I think we have a rough idea what democracy is.
Good.
More and more people realize that it's not working here. But let's stay with the point that this is a very important point for viewers to hear, is how we have weaponized democracy as a way of attacking other countries. It becomes a cloak for our own aggression. It becomes a way of forcing other countries on the back foot. And in fact, our record shows that we're not really that much into democracy. We have a long history of interfering in other countries when they produce democratic outcomes we don't like. We have a long history of collaborating with undemocratic countries, and we have a very flawed and failing democracy. Our democracy is deteriorating. That can't be the evidence for a country that says it's in favor of democracy. We have work to do here. We should stop trying to intervene in the affairs of others, the internal affairs of others.
I want to ask you question that just popped into my mind. I'm studying psychology, both collective and individual psychology. And whenever you start doing psychological work or any developmental work, you start where you are. And it's not a linear progress, but essentially you solve one issue, you move to the next, and there's some regression always. But what is important is to treat yourself with patience, with empathy, to invest in your development, and to treat yourself seriously. Where does this idea that societies can somehow arrive at democracy all of a sudden, that they can be indoctrinated into democracy, come from? Because I simply don't understand how such a complicated and complex organism as a country could become a democracy overnight, even if institutions are brought there.
Well, I think that, again, that is really of the essence here. And that's why I talked about the United States weaponizing democracy. We know that democracy is very hard to come by. It's a very long historical process. Each country has its own historical conditions. Some have been more advantaged and more fortunate than others, perhaps for reasons of geography, perhaps for reasons of where scientific revolution landed earlier or not, or perhaps for reasons of culture. But so we know that you cannot just plant democracy overnight. And it's in that way that the United States is weaponizing democracy. I would say the Anglo-Saxon countries got ahead of the game a little bit, and they were advantaged. But now they've turned it around where other countries are trying to find ways of improving living standards for their citizens, of strengthening their governance, improving their state of affairs. The United States says, if you're not a democracy, you're an enemy. And then they accompany it with this terrible story that's throughout all the Washington think tanks here of this sort of axis of autocracies. And this is part of that there's an autocratic alliance around the world aimed at subverting democracy. And this is part of how they drum up aggression, support nationalism, paranoia, support for the military, support for these foreign wars of intervention. Of course, it's completely false. In fact, the evidence says the exact opposite. Look at the history of who's been involved in wars over the last 20 years. It's the U.S. Look at something like the defense budgets. The United States defense budget is as large as the next 10 countries all added together. Right now, and I hope it doesn't last, is that the United States is leading an aggression against these other countries. And I don't know how to get that. If people aren't willing to look at the evidence, and if people aren't willing to consider the other proposition, then we will just be led by the nose, which is what's happening right now in our politics, and which is particularly the case in Europe right now.
Well, Mr. Paley, we have to take a very short break, but we will come back to this conversation in a short while. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Thomas Paley, an American economist and the founder of the Economics for Democratic and Open Societies project. Mr. Paley, as we've been talking before the break, it's impossible to export democracy, but I wonder if American policymakers understand that democracy also needs maintenance. It's impossible to keep it eternal without actually doing much work. Do you think that resonates with the Americans? Because I think in the American society, there is a lot of this end of history sort of theme, and they assume that once they arrive at democracy, nothing has to be done and it will be there forever. Can that be taken for granted?
I think you're too nice to say that they think of it in terms of the end of history. They're not that intellectual, our leaders. What we have is capture. I mean, we have flawed democracy. And actually, it's rather interesting. Even I read recently in The Economist magazine that does a democracy index, and The Economist is quite a right-wing magazine. And he said that the United States was a flawed democracy. And we have not, and there's no conversation really about improving it. I mean, obviously there's some NGOs here, some center-left people who say that we need to make changes, but there's no desire. I mean, think of it, our Senate, 100 senators, 2 senators per state, so that Wyoming, with 650,000 people, has the same representation, 2 senators, as California with 43 million people. And we have a huge problem with gerrymandering, where we use computers now to draw boundaries so that we can really get the biggest advantage. By if one group, we cluster them all together, they win their seat with an 80%, 20% vote. And the dominant party then rearranges the rest of the map so they can win their seats with, say, 52 to 48%. That way you can actually control the democracy even if you don't have a majority representation. Indeed, by the way, that I think has happened twice already in our presidential election. Remember, George Bush got fewer total votes than Al Gore. Donald Trump got fewer total votes than Hillary Clinton. If that happened in another country, guess what our media would be saying and so on, but we're blind to it here. We could manage this thing. We could draw competitive districts, encourage competition. We could have different ways of counting votes. So we have all the equipment to do it. But above all, the system is locked down and owned by big money. The rich and powerful in this country, and they work through the corporations, they own the system. So we have an extremely flawed democracy right now. I don't think The Economist does anything like enough justice to how flawed we are. But at least it has it says and notes that.
And I think you highlighted all the challenges associated with getting to power. But I think there is also a second part of how one uses that power and whether, you know, that governing structure is enough to implement substantial change in the lives of the people, because ultimately politics exists for governance and it has to do some practical work around that, not the other way around. What levers at this point do you think an average American has to not only get his or her interest voiced or heard, but actually pursued by the politicians or elected leaders?
Well, look, in defense of fairness here, let me just roll back. The system, the problem of capture and not being responsive to change afflicts every system. And authoritarian systems, as you learned in Russia in the Soviet era, could be pretty unresponsive and could be pretty captured. So every political system needs to think about this problem. If you want to talk about the United States.
Well, can I stop you here? Because I don't want it to be only about the United States, because, I mean, Russia is often referred to as an autocracy, but I know for sure that I have a lot of levers. For example, if there's something in my neighborhood, just a couple of weeks ago, there was something like in my backyard, I made a call, I wrote a complaint, and, you know, a couple of hours later, it was eliminated. So there are many mechanisms in Russia to actually influence life on the ground. Now, it could be argued that, you know, Vladimir Putin has been in power for so long. But if you actually look at the, at the offer of the candidates for the upcoming presidential elections, we have 5 of them in the running, and some of them are pretty young and, handsome and attractive. But the population seems to be honestly and authentically voting in favor of a certain party. Now, you may dislike it in the United States, but I think part of that has to do with the efficacy of governance. And this is one more question that I want to ask you. How, like, in focusing on labels so much, whether any particular government is a democracy or an autocracy, aren't we losing sight of what it actually delivers for the people? Because people don't care whether it's Putin or Biden, you know, what's their last name or ideological affiliation. They care whether, you know, they bring something that brings something better into their lives.
Yes, I don't want you to misinterpret. I was just making a general point that every political system confronts this problem. And quite clearly, Russia has a political system, and there's political competition, and there's a lively politics there. I mean, that's part of the misrepresentation of Russia and China, too, in our society, as if they have no politics, as if President Putin is a dictator. He's not. He works within a political system.
Well, we
system.
Don't care and what... I think in the Russian culture, the word is important, but what supports that word is more important than the word itself.
And absolutely. And President Putin is clearly popular. He wins the election by popular consent. I want to say also that, again, I want to come back and talk as a... not an expert on internal affairs in Russia. Yeah. I want to talk about a little about Russia-U.S. Mm-hmm. relations here. I think what we are doing, actually, if we were interested in democracy, everything we're doing is actually a setback to democracy. Because when countries are attacked from the outside, as I believe we've been engaged, not a military attack, but in a slow motion war of aggression on the border states, with a long-term plan, I would say this, if I put it on the table here, maybe we won't discuss it. I would say within the United States, within the State Department and the Pentagon, there are plans in part to try and deconstruct Russia. Just as the Soviet Union fell apart, the fractures were the republics, so too people here believe they can do the same thing with Russia itself. And Russians need to understand that. The United States has a long-term enmity against Russia, and by attacking it, and doing the same for China, it actually encourages a retreat from democracy. This is, by the way, also what happened in this country after 9/11. When we were attacked by a criminal gang, the Bush administration used it as cause to roll back our democratic
freedom. Well, Mr. Pelley, I'm not sure I would agree with you here, because, I mean, I think the fact that American policy is not very friendly towards either Russia or China, it's pretty clear. But on the other hand, I mean, you may have these adversarial intentions, but as an economist, you know, you need to, fortify them by actual means of achieving them. And the Russians have known about that all along, and they put efforts and money into creating a military sector, into strengthening their defenses, and also into making sure that their economy is self-sufficient. The same goes for China. I wonder if the American elites who have these hegemonic intentions actually do their homework to, you know, do the numbers to make sure that they can achieve those goals, whatever those goals are, practically, not just in form of wishful thinking, but practically.
Well, that's obviously a big debate, and it's a debate that is taking place inside here. I think that there is a recalibration taking place. You may have heard of globalization being on the rocks, as it were. The original goal coming out of the sort of the end of history story was, and it used to be called sort of the Wall Street model of globalization, was the United States was going to become the headquarters of world capital. Wall Street was going to be the headquarters. And then it would have junior partners, much like, say, Britain today is a junior partner, or Germany is a junior partner. The hope was that China and Russia would come on as junior partners. And they didn't accept that, with good reason. They did not. I read a recent book about, it's called Sub-Imperialism by an Australian author, where the system was an imperial power of the United States. Below its sub-imperial powers, those sub-imperial powers have some foreign policy authority, but it's all subservient to the imperial power. Then there are vassal states who have no foreign policy rights at all, and then there's the rest. This was sort of the Wall Street model. And it's fallen apart. The United States was going to run the world through finance, And it was willing to outsource all its manufacturing. And they thought it was going to work. And now it doesn't work. And the United States is recalibrating as a result. We are trying to bring back some manufacturing, but we're recalibrating in two ways. A little bit of, I don't know how much we can bring back. Instead, we've gone on the side of aggression. So we do things like try to block the transfer of technology. We try to exclude others, and we try to sabotage the economic development of others. And maybe, if need be, we'll try and, as I think Russia is finding through Ukraine and some of the border state activities through NATO, by military threat and maybe military force. So all of the U.S. elite is very much aware of the problem and is recalibrating as such. It's not, but whether it'll work or not, it's another issue.
I think the world has its own thinking to do. And when I attend various international organizations, it seems that many countries are actually choosing the path of their own, you know, intellectual and sometimes industrial economic autonomy, because they don't no longer want to rely on anyone for strategic decisions. And that's an interesting development. And sometimes I get a sense that, you know, many of them have this not only sort of burgeoning of sovereignty, but also sort of a lack of understanding why the United States is resisting the objective flow of history, because many of them see what's happening right now not as the purposeful decline of the West, but rather as the rising of the rest of the world, and each country bringing, you know, its own strengths and weaknesses to the fore. And that's normal. I mean, this is a big world. We all want to develop and, you know, help each other develop. I sometimes wonder if all this talk about the end of history is ultimately a cover for the United States not being able to afford itself to have this historical and long view perspective, because Russia has it, China has it, Brazil has it. Many countries that have transitional governments have it, but it seems that the United States is forever locked in the election campaigning rather than a real discussion on how the country should be governed and what are the priorities and the distribution of responsibilities between big money and social organization and social welfare.
First of all, autonomy, countries really, there are few countries that can really be anything like autonomous. Actually, the United States is about as close as you can get to that. It's continental in size, 350 million people, Canada to the north with a lot of resources, Mexico to the south with a lot of people. The North American economy can essentially go it alone. I don't think Russia can. I don't even think China can. China is in need of resources for its large population and its manufacturing and so on. So the rest of the world, there's a lot to be gained from coexisting in a peaceful world that promotes economic development. And that's what I was talking about, that the need for, and that's why I think it's such a tragedy to shift the world in a direction that fractures it in this way. And I think the rise of the rest should be seen as a blessing. This is a way that we are going to raise living standards, improve political life throughout the world. When the United States, because it sees itself through an imperial lens, and this it runs very deep into the culture and the people, ordinary people see it in those terms too, they're not in the same crazy way that our neocon policymakers do. But it's very easy then, if you have that view, that you are somehow exceptional, that you're always right with the right to do as you want. If you have this imperial mind, then it's very easy to turn the rise of the rest into a zero-sum game. And when you turn it into a zero-sum game, then you're going to have antagonism.
Well, even if you are exceptional or a shining city on a hill, that does not free you from doing some basic reality checks. And you can look at basic economic indicators of the United States to see how much or how little that has brought to an ordinary American over the last 20 or 30 years. Anyway, Mr. Paley, we have to leave it there. I wish I had more time with you, but thank you very much for this enlightening discussion.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.
We'll be right back.